John Delvey and Al Tuck. For Tuck, they claim for offering for a common federal group, and they're staying in for the acting.
Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court. My name is Agnieszka Frischman, and I represent the plaintiffs. I'll be presenting argument on the state law claims, also on some preliminary matters that apply to both cases, as well as the Torture Victim Protection Act, which applies only to the Doe 1 case. My colleague, Mr. Hoffman, will be covering the Alien Tort Statute, which only applies to the Doe 1 case. I would like to reserve 7 minutes, if I may, for rebuttal. I guess I would like to begin with the only state law issue on appeal by the appellants, which is standing. The district court dismissed on the grounds that aliens, as a general rule, do not have standing to appeal in a United States court. The defendants do not seek to defend that ruling. Instead, they argue that there's a zone of interest limitation, but that limitation grew out of the growth of the administrative state to give context to the aggrieved person language. It's never been applied, so far as I've been able to tell, to the victims of a common law tort, and it's not a choice of law limitation, which is sort of how they're trying to use it. So I would ask the court now if the court has questions about standing, and if not, I'll move on. If there are no questions about standing, I'd like to address an issue that the defendants, the appellees, cross-appellants, start all of their briefs, which is that this is a case about foreign soldiers, foreign citizens in a foreign country. This is a case about an American corporation, ExxonMobil, which is incorporated in New Jersey, headquartered in Houston, and their subsidiary, ExxonMobil Oil Indonesia, which was incorporated in Delaware at all times relevant to Doe 1, but has since moved to the Cayman Islands and has principal place of business in Jakarta. There is no dispute that ExxonMobil contracted for the provision of security guards. It was done by contract, and the contract says by the request of Exxon. There is no dispute, and the district court found on summary judgment, a decision that's not on appeal here, that the defendants signed additional agreements to provide that the security guards are dedicated exclusively to providing security for our operations, and that's a quote, that they would not provide support for the general maintenance of law and order in Aceh, and that's a quote, and that they would not support any offensive military or police operations, either directly or indirectly, that's a quote, and that they do not perform a broader role with respect to military activities in the region. What they did, and we have evidence in the record that we put in the joint appendix, that Exxon did request the military security, that they paid them, and that they told them where to go and what to do. We know that they were stationed at the front desk of Exxon's facilities, just like the guards at the front desk of my office building. They checked IDs and they checked handbags. We know that they delivered diesel. We know that they escorted Exxon VIPs, and we know that they guarded, cleared the roads for Exxon convoys. We know that the plaintiffs, they often say that the plaintiffs can't show that who they were injured are, or they were injured by troops fighting a civil war. If the plaintiffs cannot show that their assailants were those guards that were the Exxon guards, then the plaintiffs won't prevail at trial. The plaintiffs will be able to show, four of them, that they were injured within Exxon's facilities, like in Exxon's plant, in the buildings. Four of them will be able to show that they were injured on the road in front of Exxon's facility, right at the fence line. Four of them can identify the trucks that the assailants came in as Exxon trucks. In one case, an eyewitness followed the truck into Exxon's facility and saw the people go. And in two cases, we have witnesses who can identify the assailants by sight because they bought food and vegetables from them at their vegetable stands. The soldiers were stationed there for some time, so they were not unknown to the community. So we have two that can say, this was the same guy that bought my fruit.
We obviously have serious objections from the government of Indonesia about this lawsuit proceeding at all, and that raises questions about the rather murky doctrine of foreign affairs preemption. And I'd be interested in your thoughts on that doctrine in particular, the Zernig case, which suggests that the doctrine has force even in the absence, or actually in that case, contrary to a statement of interest.
Two things I want to say about that. One is that Judge, is it all right if I call him Judge Oberdorfer, because it gets confusing with two district courts, and I don't want to be impolite, but Judge Oberdorfer narrowed the case significantly. There is now no claim and no result a jury could reach that would implicate any official act by the government of Indonesia, and plaintiffs have not appealed any of those claims.
That's not completely right. If you're ultimately correct about aiding and abetting jurisdiction, because you agree that, as I read your briefs, you agree that there can't be direct corporate liability under the Alien Tort Statute, and you argue for aiding and abetting, doesn't that directly implicate the actions of the Indonesian military? Because Exxon would have to be aiding and abetting something. Well, what is that something? Well, that something is the behavior of the Indonesian military.
I don't want to pre-argue for my colleague, but our entire claims under the Alien Tort Statute still rest, as do the state law claims, on the hiring of the individual soldiers, and they were always under the direction and control of
Exxon.
Well,
but if we didn't agree with that, suppose you have two bases for finding corporate liability. One is that, ExxonMobil is a state actor, but assume we didn't agree on that. Then you would rely on your aiding and abetting theory, right?
I think.
And isn't it true that that does implicate the actions of the Indonesian government?
Judge Tittle, unfortunately, my colleague, Mr. Hoffman, is the one who's prepared to argue on the Alien Tort Statute.
Fine.
And if it would
that's
be more
fine.
Convenient, I could defer no, to
that's
you now.
Fine.
So that
I don't mind. Well, I was just responding to your point that nothing would implicate the behavior of the Indonesian government. That's
as to the state tort law claims,
let's talk about that.
Those are claims of negligent hiring, negligent supervision, and assault and battery. And our theory on those is that Exxon paid, hired, told them what to do, and told them where to go, and that they've met the standard.
It's going to be essential to show, or correct me if I'm wrong, essential to show that Indonesian soldiers committed wrongdoing.
And they were essentially privatized. So
that
it's not
right?
like the U.S. military. They were privatized.
Am I right that you're going to have to show that?
Yes. And I think if an Indonesian employee of a private Indonesian security company had committed the same torts, we would have to show that an Indonesian did that. I don't think that.
Right, but
that,
these
those
are
acts, I don't think
government officials, right?
They were privatized by Exxon, though.
No,
and they
were. We're trying to draw the distinction. There was a contract.
Yes.
Between Exxon and the Indonesian government,
that
the government would provide security for Exxon's facilities.
Upon Exxon's request.
That's right. And this is not a sort of situation where Exxon hired some off-duty military people to be its security guards. The contract ties Indonesia in with its responsibility.
The contract does, because the contract was with the oil and gas ministry, but I guess I don't see the case as different as if they had hired off-duty Indonesian military. There's no evidence that the soldiers were performing an official function at any of this time. They were working exclusively for ExxonMobil. So when they were checking the handbags and the IDs at the gates of ExxonMobil's facility, they were doing it for ExxonMobil. They weren't performing, apart from being in the contract and as part of the oil and gas exploration, they weren't performing, you know, they weren't at a crossing guard, they weren't fighting a civil war, they weren't doing what I would normally think of as the acts of a military on official military duty. They were working.
The district court allowed discovery to proceed so far as it was not discovery in Indonesia.
That's correct.
And that no discovery would proceed over the objection of the Indonesian government, is that correct?
That is correct, and in fact, we've completed all of the discovery permitted by Judge Oberdorfer, and we have never heard a complaint from the government of Indonesia all that time. I think their last letter was submitted like 3 or 5 years ago, and we haven't heard from them since. And also, the
well,
State Department
you've
hasn't.
You've seen the letter that was just submitted to the court, have you not?
No.
Oh.
We got a letter yesterday.
Came yesterday.
No, I didn't get it.
Actually, it wasn't addressed to us. It was addressed to the State Department.
Right. Well, I have not seen it, so
well,
I can't.
Similar.
But what was dispositive last time was that it wasn't transmitted to the State Department. There was also a letter that came in the last time we were at the Court of Appeals.
All right, but here's what I'm getting at. Is, as I understand it now, is it true that discovery is required in Indonesia?
No.
The defendants argue that in order to defend, they would have to be able to take discovery of, for example, the very soldiers you're talking about.
The defendants have They have created a huge discovery plan, and the court has the discretion to limit that as mm-hmm. they limited our discovery. We don't think their discovery is appropriate or necessary, and I frankly think it was done to calculatedly to create a sort of political question argument. I think the discovery can be limited, and our position is there is no discovery that is necessary in Indonesia at all, and there's certainly no discovery of the type that they've proposed that would be necessary or appropriate.
Can I ask you about your the choice of law question? Mm-hmm. You're prepared to talk about that, right?
Yes.
Do you know of any D.C. Court of Appeals or any D.C. Court of Appeals decision that even hints that you would apply D.C. law in a case like this?
In a case like...
Yeah, like this, where all the actions none of the torts were committed in the District of Columbia. I don't know of a case that...
You know, mindful that this just came up in the last case, there are several D.C. Circuit decisions, like Holland and Reed, where individuals were injured in Lebanon and Iran, and they were brought suit here.
The
Foreign Sovereign Immunities Act cases go under common law.
But those weren't state law claims.
Some of those, they ended up applying Kentucky law.
Let me ask you very specifically. Here, the District of Columbia follows a restatement, section 145, and it says when it's looking at which form has the most significant contacts, that's the standard it uses, right?
Right.
You agree with that? It says, subject to only rare exceptions, the local law of the state where the conduct and injury occurred, that law will apply. So doesn't that suggest that Indonesian law applies here?
I think the interest analysis that the district court undertook was correct. In tort cases, the District of Columbia has abandoned the rule that it's always the law of the, like, I can't quite pronounce Les Loci Delecti, but the District of Columbia has abandoned that rule. They abandoned it in several cases, Semler and Tramonta. And they do the interest balancing. And if you disaggregate the claims and disaggregate
Well, but what I read you from the restatement is the District of Columbia's, this was a comment, this is what D.C. follows. Only in rare instances would they not apply the law where the tort occurred.
I think that passage of the restatement also says different factors may apply in international cases. Uh-huh. And I also think that here where you have...
So is that your point, that this is an international case? And
well, certainly the conduct, some of the conduct occurred.
In what case?
Do
you have a case that says that?
I'm sorry?
Can you cite a case that says that?
That says...
That this principle doesn't apply in international...
I think that is also in the restatement uh-huh. from what I recall, but mm-hmm. I didn't... read it as recently as you have, but I can find that and submit that to the court this afternoon. Mm-hmm. That's necessary. And
well, suppose we thought Indonesian law did apply. What would be the consequences of that for your state law claim?
Well, the district court weighed Indonesian law. We submitted 6 expert declarations, and if the court takes a look at the Hornick Declaration that is in the joint appendix, I think that was submitted by the defendants, it outlines how difficult it is to determine what Indonesian law is, because there's no official translation, there's no index of reported decisions. And so that alone, under District of Columbia rules, under Reimer versus Poole and Operango versus Watts, that alone would be enough to have a preference for the forum law. It would be very difficult to determine Indonesian law. Mm-hmm. In addition, that same declaration also says there's no conflict, because that declaration goes through the elements of, for example, negligent hiring and says the...
What about punitive damages?
In punitive damages, the traditional calculation is the one that was done in the In Re Chicago aircraft disaster case, and I think there even more strongly that all
of... Isn't there a conflict there between...
There is a conflict. There is a conflict. And, for example, as to EMC, generally what courts do is they look at the principal place of business and the principal place of incorporation as having the greatest interest as to punitive damages. And that is where the district court looks. So as to EMC, that would be either New Jersey or Texas. As to Emoy, that would be either Jakarta or Delaware at the time of 2001. And all courts, including a number of decisions that we've cited in our briefs and the District of Columbia and the District of Columbia local courts, hold that a foreign state has an attenuated interest if its interest would result in its citizens getting a lesser recovery against a foreign defendant when that foreign defendant is sued in its home jurisdiction, as here. And that's in the Raflo case, the Bucci case, and I think quite a number of...
So it's D.C. based on contacts? Is that your argument?
It's D.C. based on the fact that there is no conflict between D.C. law and the law of Texas, the law of New Jersey, and the law of Delaware. And the way the district court did the analysis, he first did the conflicts analysis, which is what is appropriate to determine whether there was a conflict. and then he found there was no conflict, so he applied forum law, which is what Justice Stevens in Allstate said, you know, way in favor of judicial efficiency also.
Except as to the wrongful death.
Except as to the wrongful death. And he also weighed the interest of the jurisdictions and found Indonesia had a lesser interest. But also in D.C. law in particular, the local D.C. courts have a very strong preference.
The interest actually tilted in favor of Indonesia, but it was the overriding interest, and then he set that aside because of an overriding U.S. interest, I guess. So it was.
But the other case law here, like in Rafflo or Bucci and the Kaiser Permanente case, the other cases express it slightly differently than he did and express it in terms of the interest of the state and being lesser when the defendant is sued here. I recognize that is what he was in the opinion, but there are plenty of other cases that express it in the way I've just said. And that the local case law in the District of Columbia expresses a very strong preference for the law of the forum where the parties haven't proved up the contents of the local law, and a very strong preference for the law of the forum where the interests are evenly balanced in the interest of judicial efficiency. So if you were looking to, Your Honors were looking to local D.C. court decisions, that's actually quite strong.
On the discovery question, suppose it turns out, suppose this the state law claim goes back, and suppose it turns out that the district court concludes that discovery cannot be conducted in a manner consistent with what the Solicitor General articulated in the cert op and the State Department had articulated. What then?
I think we would have to reach that point when we get to it. Our position is that that doesn't create a due process problem. I mean, I think that's what the issue that would be up. They would say that's a due process violation. We would say that that isn't. That I think the district court has the ability to limit discovery. And if you can't get some of the discovery, then okay, you just can't.
Saying,
we weren't able to get all
just
the
discovery. You're saying that won't arise. But if it does arise,
well, I think
what?
If it does arise, I think the court can limit it within its discretion and the case can go forward.
Limit what?
Just any discovery. I think we could go forward right now without any more discovery if we needed to. And that may be what we will end up litigating. And that is our position, is that we are ready to go to trial. We will make our experts available and make our plaintiffs available, and we can go to trial with it. We don't need any more discovery.
All right. Do you want to say the rest of the time?
I would. Thank you.
Thank you. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. Paul Hoffman. I'll be addressing the Alien Tort Statute issues. And I suppose I should start with the question that was asked about aiding and abetting, and also just clarify exactly what our position is. We have challenged both the district court's ruling on aiding and abetting and its direct liability ruling with respect to the color of law on the torture EJEs, extrajudicial executions, and prolonged arbitrary detention claims. And we do not think that they would raise any political question issues in the sense that it's a fairly narrow claim. Any claim that has to do with larger Indonesian policy, I mean, originally in the complaint at the beginning there were claims about genocide and other things, but those are not the claims any longer. The claims are that state actors, the military, that was privatized, as Ms. Frisman indicated, who are state actors for the purpose of torture, extrajudicial execution, or prolonged arbitrary detention, they committed the violations. And then the question is Exxon, are the defendants responsible either because of aiding and abetting, or because they acted in joint participation with those soldiers and therefore acted under color of law. Now, the district court decided pretty much with respect to both of those that that expanded the scope of the Alien Tort Statute beyond what he thought was appropriate. And he relied in large part on a district court decision in the apartheid cases in New York, which has since been overturned by the Second Circuit in the Kulamani case, and then the Second Circuit has further decided the standard for aiding and abetting in that circuit in the Talisman case. The 11th Circuit has decided that there's aiding and abetting under federal common law principles, particularly using this court's decision in the Halberstam case as the gold standard for the standard for federal common law.
Even if there is aiding and abetting liability, of course, there's a separate question several separate questions, right? But one big one, which is the corporate liability question.
The corporate liability issue is obviously the largest issue that the defendants have put before the court for the first time in
this appeal. Just on that, a couple questions.
Sure.
Footnote 20 of SOSA certainly seems to indicate that we look not just to the scope of the norm itself, but to the scope of the norm with respect to who can be liable.
It actually doesn't. I mean, that's just an absolute misreading of the SOSA footnote.
Okay.
I say that as categorically as I litigated SOSA for 11 years and argued it, and know that that issue was not briefed or argued anywhere. And that footnote dealt with an issue that had
the footnote's uninformed.
The Second Circuit, first of all, the Second Circuit, and it's only this one panel of the Second Circuit, is the only circuit, and I think the only court, that has read footnote 20 to mean that. And that footnote 20 dealt with the issue of whether any particular issue within an ATS case was required to be decided by international law other than the violation. What had been litigated frequently, and particularly in the corporate cases starting with Doe versus Unocal on, was the question of which norms required state action and which didn't. And the cases that
wouldn't it make sense then, if you're looking at customary international law, to say some norms require state action, some don't.
Right.
But for those that don't, they require individual action. There's no liability against corporations.
No, in fact, I mean, as Judge LaValle says in his concurrence, right, what footnote 20 doesn't distinguish between corporations and private actors. And in fact, if you look at what the court cited to describe the conflict it was describing was the Hanak-Teloran case, which is this circuit's case, which actually dealt with a non-individual. It dealt with the PLO, actually. And the fact that it dealt with the PLO was of no concern to the court. What was the concern to the court was that it dealt with private action, because the PLO was a private actor.
Customary international law, you acknowledge, or maybe you don't, does not extend liability typically to corporations.
It depends on what question you're asking with that.
Well,
general principles
Nuremberg,
of law do.
Yugoslavia, Rwanda, Genocide Convention,
International
Torture Convention, those do not extend liability to corporations, and those are considered decisions. And the question is, do we just ignore that in applying customary international law here and thus allow the ATS to have a broader scope than customary international law does?
Well, first of all, I mean, to back up for a second, I mean, that deals with international criminal tribunals. That's all it does. Almost all of those citations are about international criminal tribunals. And the issue of international criminal liability is a completely different issue from civil liability. The Alien Tort Statute is a tort statute. Mm-hmm. I mean, it says so in the statute. And all of those criminal tribunals, in fact, the Rome Statute itself says it's not intended to displace customary international law. Many of the states that implement the Rome Statute implement it with criminal liability against corporations. And what we're talking about is civil liability. General principles of corporate civil liability are recognized throughout the world. There is no country, there is no legal system for which you cannot
get tort liability for these kinds of torts. Right, but am I right that no court, certainly the defendants here say no national court outside the U.S. and no international judicial tribunal has recognized corporate liability for violations of the law of nations or CIL.
Per se, yeah, and no one has recognized that a torturer like the torturer in Florida was subject to civil liability either. In fact, you would overturn Florida if you adopt the reasoning in that case, which is why it's completely inconsistent with the entire body of alien tort statute jurisprudence.
I thought the position you took in your brief on this issue was that international law directs courts to look to local law for this question, and that's Judge Edwards' concurring opinion in Tel-Orn, right?
Exactly, and in fact, SOSA. SOSA confirms right about the point where it has this footnote, actually, right before the footnote, confirms that this has been a debate between different schools of thought, but from the time that Judge Bork and Judge Edwards had this debate. And Sosa sides with Edwards. It cites the Edwards opinion as the proper approach in the context of saying that most of the judges that had handled alien tort statute cases from Phil Artiga on had gotten it right.
Are you sure it's cited with Judge Edwards on that issue?
Yes, it cites it right after Florida. Well, that's how we interpret it.
Let me ask you a broader question about. Assume for purposes of this question that we don't think there's corporate liability under the Torture Act. Okay.
Okay.
Just assume that.
Right.
And you know a lot about Sosa, so you can help me with this one. Okay. Sosa says. Sosa warns courts like us that the decision to create a private right of action is one better left to legislative judgment in the great majority of cases, particularly when foreign affairs are implicated, right? Okay?
Right.
So if there isn't corporate liability under the Torture Act, doesn't Sosa suggest to us that we shouldn't recognize it under the Alien Tort Statute either?
I don't think so, because for one thing, Sosa recognized that the TVPA was a different statute.
Yeah. No, it's a different statute, but I'm asking whether or not, you know, when we're trying to read the, trying to understand the implications of Sosa for us.
But I think what Sosa also says, and where I think another place where the Kiobel majority goes off the rails, is not looking at the text and history and purpose of the Alien Tort Statute, just as the Sosa court did. And the text of the Alien Tort Statute is different from the text of the TVPA. The text of the Alien Tort Statute, in the original, it says all causes, and it says torts, and it limits the who can be plaintiffs, and it has no limitation.
The Alien Tort Statute is just a jurisdictional grant.
In Sosa, the court found that it was jurisdictional, but it found that it was jurisdictional with an understanding that the first Congress believed that courts would enforce it with common law torts.
No, I agree with that. But Sosa Sosa wasn't focused on the question of corporate liability.
No, it wasn't. It wasn't before the court at all.
Uh-huh. And so how would you argue and again, assuming that there's no corporate liability under the Torture Act.
The first thing I would say is I'd say that if you analyze the ATS, first of all, that the founders understood that corporations would be liable for tort. The amicus briefs give you lots of cases that go back long before long before 1789. The common law provided for corporate tort liability. This is a tort statute. There are no limitations on defendants. There's absolutely no rational reason why you would exclude a particular defendant. If there was a corporation in 1789 that was engaged in piracy that could be sued in Boston, there's no reason to deprive anybody of an ability to get recompense from that corporation. And it would have been understood that way by the founders. So there's absolutely no limit on who can be a defendant, whether it's a corporation, the PLO, anybody within the Alien Tort Statute.
But what Judge Tatel's suggesting, I think, is that Congress, of course, can alter that, and the Supreme Court in Sosa suggests it can do it directly or indirectly, explicitly or implicitly. And let me finish the question.
Yes, I'm sorry.
And the question becomes, given what Congress did under the hypothetical in the TVPA, not extending liability to corporations, your approach would mean that aliens could sue corporation for torture, but U.S. citizens could not. And does that make any sense as a matter of congressional intent?
There are a lot of differences between the Torture Victim Protection Act and the Alien Tort Statute. The Torture Victim Protection Act.
What sense does it make to think that Congress intended for aliens to be able to sue corporations for torture, but not for U.S. citizens to be able to sue? What sense?
I don't know whether it makes any sense that Congress didn't expand the TVPA to all the issues that the ATS governs. I don't know that there's
And your answer about the ATS means what it means and TVPA means what it means would be a strong argument. It is a strong argument regardless, but it would be even stronger. But for Sosa suggests that we look, as Judge Tatel suggested, to what else is out there.
But the Torture Victim Protection Act, when you're looking at it, I mean, if you put aside the specific question on corporations, and obviously our position is that it did not intend to exclude corporations, that really what the only thing
all
that
the,
they were
all
trying
all these questions
to,
are on the are, these are no, all hypothetical
I
questions.
I understand. Right. And, the one thing that is clear from the Torture Victim Protection Act in the reports is that Congress did not intend to limit the Alien Tort Statute in any way. It intended to side with the view of the Alien Tort Statute other than Judge Bork's, because it specifically was in response to Judge Bork's opinion in large part. And it was in part a response to one of my clients in the Marcos litigation, who was a naturalized American citizen and had been a Philippine torture victim during the Marcos regime, and that seemed unfair. But Congress did not intend to legislate comprehensively to occupy the field of that. It actually specifically said there's this Alien Tort Statute, and it covers a lot of things more than we have, and this is what we're doing.
Well, we get some mixed signals. First of all, that's in the legislative reports, not in the statute, but I take your point that that's still relevant. But then we get the mixed signal, arguably, from SOSA of looking to what else is out there. And because it says explicitly or implicitly, that really to draw signals from implicit congressional action is not exactly easy. So that's what we're trying to do.
But it seems to me that the other issue about the Torture and Victim Protection Act is that no matter how you come down on that issue, and obviously we've laid out all the reasons why you ought not to find corporations excluded, you will find virtually nothing in the legislative history that suggests that Congress did not want to sue corporations. In other words, there's nothing out there that says we don't want to have corporations sue.
There's nothing that says we don't want American citizens to be able to sue for torture, but we want aliens to be able to sue for torture in U.S. courts.
Well, but that's explicit.
That's the question. I mean, if there was something in the reports that said that, then okay, that would be. I would think that.
You know, I don't know that I have a better answer. I mean, I think that
but you agree it's odd, right? It's an odd result to think that the U.S. Congress would say.
I think most of the courts that have looked at the Torture Victim Protection Act and have heard preemption kinds of arguments of all sorts, because they've been made, have rejected them on the ground that the Torture Victim Protection Act is very clear that it was not meant to displace the Alien Tort Statute. And I think that the history of the Alien Tort Statute shows that corporations would have been within the kinds of entities that would be sued for tort. Corporate tort liability is there throughout the world. I think what footnote 20 doesn't mean to look to international law in that way. The structure of international law point, which is the main point of the Edwards opinion that I think Sosa accepted, was that international law leaves that to domestic courts. And in this case, the founders decided that they would enforce the law of nations, and Sosa interpreted that for our time, for now. I mean, it's left a lot of issues that we're fighting about. But the one thing is clear, Sosa decided that the Alien Tort Statute applies to at least some international human rights claims, and therefore the purposes of the Alien Tort Statute are to effectuate those claims. And so the purpose would be to find anybody, the aiders and abettors, the accomplices, if it's a corporation. If I.F. Farben existed in today's world, and was engaged in a Holocaust, isn't it absurd to think that you could not sue them, and that the only people you might be able to sue would be some individuals that might be in jail someplace and have no assets? It's ludicrous. And that's the force of Judge LaValle's dissent.
I understand your argument about that. I want to ask you a question about the consequences of your argument here, and the consequences of you succeeding. Assume that we end up agreeing that there is corporate liability under the Alien Tort Statute, and that there's aiding and abetting or a public act or whatever, either way, but that the corporations are liable. The briefs have a big debate about, okay, then what's the standard, right? Is it knowledge-based or is there a purpose, right? Do you have to have a purpose? So, your argument is all you need is knowledge. So suppose, for example, you have a nonprofit organization, an NGO that provides food assistance to foreign countries. And suppose that this nonprofit provides food to, say, North Korea. And it knows that some of that food is being diverted to the North Korean military, that the food's being used to keep people in the military, and that they know that the military is committing human rights violations. Should that nonprofit be liable under the Alien Tort Statute?
No.
And so how do you distinguish that case from this case?
Because I think that that is very much analogous to the doing business kind of theory that everybody, that many defendants have ascribed to plaintiffs and no plaintiffs have ever actually asserted, which is that, I mean, in the Doe versus Unocal case,
explain to me, what's the difference between that?
It's the attenuation between they know
that their food is being used by the military to commit human rights violations. The food is being used by the military is eating food, okay?
Right.
And the military is committing, right?
Right.
So no liability.
There has to be
Because it's food?
No, I think there has to be a much closer chain of causation between...
Okay, you need to help us understand that. We're the ones who have to write the opinion.
I thought your argument was you don't need purpose, but you do need direct and substantial...
Assistance, right. There are other parts of this test that...
And the distinction is that one of the amicus briefs draws between the banker who's lending money...
Right.
As opposed to the corporation who's selling gas for the purpose.
Right. I mean, each factual circumstance would be different, but there's going to have to be a very direct connection between both the knowledge of what you're doing, substantial nature of your assistance, and the impact that it has.
Could the nonprofit, in my hypothetical, get its case dismissed, or would it have to?
I think so.
You could.
I think so. I don't think those allegations state a claim under the Alien Tort Statute.
Uh-huh.
And I think that to show you how difficult, I mean, to think, these are not easy cases. I mean,
no kidding.
You don't, I mean, for us too. And if you look at the Talisman case in the district court, Judge Coates' decision, which is the one that probably goes into much more detail about the other elements of the aiding and abetting standard. She goes into substantial assistance and what is substantial assistance and the links between the knowledge, because there was knowledge in Talisman. And I don't think that was the problem. That wasn't what led to the summary judgment. What led to the summary judgment was she didn't believe that there was a close enough connection between the particular defendant and the assistance and the substantial nature of it. And so, even if you accept what I think is fairly clearly the customary international law definition, which is a knowledge standard, that doesn't mean that it opens up the floodgates. We still have to, a plaintiff is going to have to prove that knowledge.
Okay, I got it. Okay. One other question. Your co-counsel said you would talk to us about political question and comedy.
Yeah, well,
you want to?
Yes, no, I'd be happy to. I think that the political question issue would not be any more of a problem given the relative narrowness of these claims. I mean, we're really talking about the same set of facts. The question is, did Exxon provide some assistance that led directly to these soldiers committing these acts?
So you would take issue with the district court's interpretation of the nature of the complaint.
Well, the nature of the complaint was different.
But it still has, it doesn't deny the fact of the contract, that it was the Indonesian government that agreed to provide the security.
Well, sure. But in fact, I mean, one part of the argument here is that these soldiers, first of all, were restricted in what they did, and they were very much tied to Exxon, which is different from many fact patterns in this area.
What I was trying to think of, just take it locally, you know, D.C. police officer, he's hired by a hotel to act as a security guard in his off-duty time. Now, you don't get to the district government that way, but it would be different if the hotel had a contract with the district government to provide security. And that, I thought, was was underlying the district court's concern.
Well, but I think that, if what happens is that the entity agrees that on-duty police officers, you know, state actors, can be used for this private purpose, and you know, which they could do. I mean, it's probably unusual in our context, but they could do it.
But that was the point. I thought the district court was saying you'd have to inquire into the Indonesian government's policy decision to allow its military to.
I don't think you have to, because the only thing you have to do for the violation, for the actual violation of the law of nations, is have a state actor that engages in torture, extrajudicial killing, or prolonged arbitrary detention. That is not an Indonesian policy. In fact, we've alleged that it's against Indonesian law. That doesn't make them any less state actors. It doesn't take them out of the norms themselves. It just makes our claim a very narrow claim.
Well, isn't the political question issue quite a bit different for the ATS claim than for the state law claim, you know, in its preemption, arguably there, in the sense that the U.S. government's statement of interest, as articulated and described in the CERDOP in the earlier case,
but I think
still applied to the federal claims. So the United States, at least under the current record, is still objecting to the ATS claims going forward. And that's quite a bit different than what we have with respect to at least how they describe their objection to the state law.
But the State Department statements of interest, as these things go, is not the strongest kind of statement of interest, in the sense that, and this is also,
it says adjudication of this lawsuit at this time would in fact risk a potentially serious adverse impact on significant interests of the United States, including interests related directly to the ongoing struggle against international terrorism. I take that seriously, and I think footnote 21 suggests that we have to take that seriously.
It is important to take it seriously, for sure. And in fact, the district court...
You said it wasn't that strong.
It's not that strong in the sense that there are many statements of interest that say you have to dismiss this case.
And the
Department of State draws distinctions between how it frames
this.
And
the government articulates that objection, the U.S. government, and then it is dismissed, the ATS claims, in part for that reason. And then the U.S. government comes in the Solicitor General's brief in the prior version of this and says, we objected, but our objection was satisfied by dismissal of the federal claims. As I understand it, the objection of the federal claims by the U.S. government still stands.
Well, but it's unclear.
ATS claims.
I think it's unclear. I mean, I think if this court decided...
It's unclear? What's unclear about it?
Because we don't know what the current position of the United States government is with respect to where things stand now, with respect to which claims are there. There were different claims before, broader claims that they were worried about. There's a history of discovery that's led to this point that has gone on without incident. I mean, I think that those are things that a district judge would
consider. They said, though, that the federal claims, even the existence of the ATS claims, at least as the Solicitor General's position in Doe, even the existence of the ATS claims is a problem from the perspective of the United States government.
Well, you know, I think, first of all, I would...
And that hasn't gone away. They could come in and say that's no longer the case, but I haven't seen anything like that.
I think what would have to happen is that, as we would see it, that the court should reverse the decision that the judge made, district judge made. It should go back to the district court. If the United States is concerned about these narrow
make
claims,
them. In
other
words,
they'll say something.
It's lapsed because of the number of years. And that's a fair point that it's been a long time.
And there are many cases where the United States has changed its position. If you look at the Rio Tinto case, it's gone, you know, back and forth.
Including arguably this one.
Yeah, and so you don't know. And I think that it's important not to anticipate that it would be true, especially given the changed nature of the case. I would also point out there are very few alien tort statute cases that have been dismissed on political question grounds. I mean, very few.
Right. Well, Sosa comes in and really, with footnote 21, triggers, you're well aware, a new focus on that issue and what.
But even in Kulamani, the court did not dismiss on political question. It went back down in light of footnote 21. The first question that I was asked in oral argument was, you know, doesn't footnote 21 say we should dismiss your case? And, you know, I
What did you say?
And the rest is history.
I fear I have one more line of inquiry on the ATS claim. Sorry. But on the presumption against extraterritorial application, which is raised significantly in one of the amicus briefs,
yes,
alluded to in the defendant's briefs, why isn't that, and I realize you could say there's been 30 years of litigation on this, and that's a good answer, but I haven't had 30 years of litigation on this. It's the first time, and I don't have a precedent from the Supreme Court or this court on that question. And it's an interesting question. Why doesn't the Aramco standard cover this?
Well, there are a couple of responses. First of all, the presumption on extraterritoriality applies when it's clear that Congress has not said anything or indicated that it should be beyond their borders. The ATS clearly was beyond our borders because piracy is beyond our borders. By definition, this was a statute that looked beyond our
clearly
borders.
The high seas, right?
Yeah, well, but the thing is, extraterritoriality is whether it's in our borders or not in our borders. The other issue that they've raised about within the territory of another state, that's not the principle of extraterritoriality. They're trying to read into the statute some limit that's not there, and I can argue that point if you'd like, but the extraterritoriality point, in SOSA itself, the United States government filed in part of its brief, said that the ATS was not extraterritorial, and remember, in SOSA, the facts are entirely extraterritorial by definition, because all the claims that took
place... The absence of an equivalent to footnote 20 or footnote 21 is significant, arguably. I think that's a fair point, too.
I mean, I think those that want to argue the extraterritoriality point need to go to the Supreme Court and ask them to change it, because I think SOSA is an extraterritorial case that went forward despite an explicit objection by the U.S. government on extraterritorial grounds, and SOSA also endorsed a line of cases... All of which are extraterritorial.
If that happens, I don't want the Supreme Court to say, well, the Court of Appeals should have looked at this question and not assume that SOSA decided it. So I'm trying to avoid that.
Right, but I think aside from SOSA, in terms of just the way you would look at it independently, and the fact that you have an unbroken line of cases, where all of these cases are extraterritorial from Florida on down. That's the whole point of it, in a way. This line of cases deals with the modern law of international human rights, which deals with the way that foreign governments and our own...
It is interesting, especially with the government of Indonesia's objections, that the original theory, as articulated in Aramco, behind the presumption was not to involve us in international discord. And obviously the extraterritorial application of this case is precisely involving some international discord with Indonesia, if you take their objections seriously.
Discord was always surrounding these issues.
Right. The idea, and this Judge Kleinfeld points this out, the idea of the ATS was to eliminate discord by allowing a remedy for torts committed in the United States, not to create discord by necessarily allowing remedies.
I think it was to eliminate discord by committing the government, by committing our new nation to the law of nations and its enforcement in an even-handed way. That was what we were saying to the world. That's what would eliminate discord, not the fact that the issues would not be controversial, because they would be.
Well, the latest letter we received is carefully written, and so it is a part of the record of this case, and certainly you should look at it.
Yes.
Sorry,
thank you,
Your Honor. All right. Let us hear from appellees. Good morning.
Good morning. Thank you, Your Honors, and may it please the Court. This case involves allegations that Indonesian soldiers abused Indonesian citizens on Indonesian soil during an Indonesian civil war. The Supreme Court in SOSA...
Right, but the question is whether an American corporation is liable for that.
Sure, Your Honor. And
you left that out.
I'm sorry?
I said you left that out.
No, we left that part out, but that part, I think, at the end of the day, doesn't make a difference with respect
to
either
the federal claims or the state claims. Well, that's what distinguishes this case from your hypothetical.
No, I don't think so, Your Honor. And I could address the federal claims first and then the state claims if you'd like, or I could do it in a different order.
Why don't we start with the federal claims?
Okay, let's start with the federal claims. Federal claims, the principal focal point, of course, is the Alien Tort Statute. Uh-huh. And as to that, Judge Tatel, it does, the defendant, at least one of the defendants in this case, is an American corporation. But that doesn't matter, because corporate liability under the Alien Tort Statute shouldn't be recognized for the reasons that the Second Circuit outlined in the Kiobel decision, but also for the additional reason that was raised in the questioning this morning, which is that Kiobel stands for the proposition that international law governs the question of whether there's corporate liability under the Alien Tort Statute.
If this were the Second Circuit, this would all be easy. But,
right.
You know, I mean, we will read the Second Circuit's decision. But the question I have for you is, I mean, the closest thing we have in our circuit is Judge Edwards' concurring opinion in Telorin. And he says that to determine corporate liability, you look, international law directs us to our law. Right? And so why shouldn't we follow that?
Well, of course, that was pre-Sosa. Footnote 20 of Sosa, I think, directs attention to international law.
Well, I'm not sure it does. Before you go on footnote 20, sure. Let's just talk about footnote 20, okay?
Sure.
I think what it says, well, let me just tell you what I think it says, and you tell me why you think I'm wrong, okay? Sure. It seems to me that what this footnote says is that some offenses under international law, like torture, can only be committed by state actors.
Correct.
Okay. While other offenses, like genocide, can be done by individuals. And you know this when you look at the two sites in the footnote.
Right.
Okay, he compares Judge Edwards' Telorin opinion, where he says that torture by non-state actors doesn't violate customary law, and he compares it with a Second Circuit question holding that a private person can violate genocide. So this doesn't say anything about corporate liability at all. It says it's talking about who can be responsible for violating certain international norms. That's the way I read footnote 20.
Right, and I think the
you agree with that?
I agree with that, but Your Honor, I think I would add the following.
Yeah.
Which is that the same understanding that leads to the conclusion that the distinction between private actors and state actors goes to the scope of liability would also lead to the conclusion necessarily that the distinction between corporate actors and non-corporate actors also goes to liability. And the reason is this. Our argument, and this is what the Second Circuit said in Kiobel, and I understand you're not bound by that, of course, I'm just citing it for its persuasive force.
Right, that's fine.
The reason is that as a matter of international law, corporations don't form the requisite mens rea to violate the relevant norm in the first place. So they're not actors that violate the norm. If they're not actors that violate the norm, there, by definition, is no international law consensus
that extends the norm to
corporations.
But there is an international law consensus, according to Judge Edwards, that we to determine who's liable for violating international law, we look to our local law. What's wrong with it? That seems to me to be correct. Why should this circuit not follow that?
I'd respectfully disagree with it because, at the least, I think for the same reason that footnote 20 of Sosa points you to international law to decide whether the distinction between private actors and state actors matters, I think we now know that the distinction between corporate actors and non-corporate actors is also governed by international law because it goes to the question of whether there's an international law violation.
Well, let me ask
you
the question this way.
No,
suppose I don't. I'm sorry, Johnny. Suppose I don't agree with. Suppose I think Judge Edwards right.
Sure.
What can you give us a reason why in this case we shouldn't recognize corporate liability under our law?
Yes, and I think it gets to some of the questions Your Honor was raising. There's two particular reasons.
Yeah.
First, Congress's treatment of the issue under the Torture Victims Protection Act.
Let's assume we agree with you that the torture victim, that there's no corporate liability under that, okay? And also assume that, at least I think you've waived, this is an assumption, that you've waived your displacement argument because it's only in a footnote, okay?
Right.
Now go ahead and make your argument.
Yeah. Well, the torture victims, it's not a displacement argument, I guess, so I'm not worried about the footnote in our brief.
You agree it's, you understand why I think it's waived.
I understand why you would think it's waived. That doesn't necessarily mean I would agree with you.
I agree with you. Okay, that's fair. That's fair. Let's assume I think it's waived.
Okay. With that understanding, yeah. I still think for the reasons Your Honors were suggesting, Sosa itself at pages 726 and 731 admonishes the lower courts to pay close attention to any guidance given by Congress. Congress spoke to the issue of torture, and that's significant because Congress spoke not only to the issue of torture but also to the issue of extrajudicial killing. So two of the three international law norms that are at issue in this case were directly dealt with by Congress in the Torture Victims Protection Act. And Congress, by assumption...
Only two.
I'm sorry?
Only two.
Only two, but the same understanding would govern the third one, too, with respect, Judge Rodgers. When Congress looked at the issue, It concluded that corporations weren't going to come within the compass of the express cause of action it supplied under the Torture Victims Protection Act. And I would add...
It sounds like your displacement argument.
Yeah.
It's not a displacement argument, Your Honor. It's that what lower courts are supposed to do when in applying the Alien Tort Statute is to fashion the contours of federal common law in a way that's consistent with any guidance given by Congress. That's the instruction given by the Supreme Court in Sosa. So this is not a displacement argument.
Even if the Torture Act doesn't recognize corporate liability, there's certainly nothing in the statute or its legislative history that tells us why Congress would have done that.
Oh, I disagree, Your Honor. We point out in our brief there's absolutely something in the legislative history. Judge Schroeder's opinion for the Ninth Circuit in Bovoto describes this in detail. The legislative history shows that initial drafts of the Torture Victims Protection Act used the term person rather than individual.
Right.
But then the next draft changed it to individual. And the reason that one can glean from the legislative history is that Congress wanted to make sure that corporations weren't covered. And that's why the statute was narrowed for persons to individuals.
That's why I said, I want you to assume you're right about that. Assume you're right about that.
Sure.
My only point was, since there's really no way to know why Congress did that, we know they did it, but we don't know why. Why would we, since I think your displacement argument is waived, why would we on our own limit the Alien Tort Statute that way? We really don't have any guidance from Congress. This is a different statute.
Well, you do have some guidance in legislative history, as I've just said, Your Honor.
Well, no, all we have is that all we know is that the Alien Tort Statute doesn't recognize corporate liability.
No, Judge Schill, maybe I wasn't being clear. Under the Torture Victims Protection Act, the legislative history shows that the reason Congress switched from the term person to individual is precisely to exclude corporate liability.
But why? That's my point.
I think
we had very clear legislative indication as to why, then we might be able to say, okay, well, look, that analysis applies equally to the Alien Tort Statute, or it doesn't. But we just don't know.
Why
would we take a statute which the Supreme Court in Sosa, you know, has embraced, the Alien Tort Statute, and limit it without any particular reason to, particularly since, again, if I think that these questions of who can be sued are questions of American law, and since American black letter American law is that corporations are responsible for the torts of their agents, what would be the reason for this court to limit the Alien Tort Statute that way? That's my question.
Because if you didn't, you'd have the highly anomalous situation that an alien could bring a torture claim against
Congress could fix that if it thought it was anomalous.
But I think what Sosa instructs is that courts should take direction from what Congress has already done in fashioning the contours of federal common law. That's what's incumbent upon this court to do.
No, but that's why I made the point about only two of the norms has Congress addressed. And, to the extent Sosa says, well, the Alien Tort Statute was supposed to take effect without more, as it were. So Congress has addressed one area, but it necessarily hasn't address the rest.
I don't know why there would be any ground for drawing a distinction between prolonged detention, which is the third norm, and torture and extrajudicial killing. If Congress made the determination expressly that corporations weren't going to be covered for extrajudicial killing and torture, I would think that the legislative guidance that we could glean from that is that Congress wouldn't have wanted corporate liability as a general matter in this area.
I think we can speculate about congressional intent, all right? And I can come up with a scenario and you can come up with a scenario. But we don't know. We just know what it did.
Right. And I think that's all you need to know. Because otherwise you'd be left with a highly anomalous conclusion.
Even
that aliens could bring actions against corporations.
Doesn't call it the Comprehensive Alien Tort Statute Victim Protection Act. You know what I'm getting at. I mean, we don't have the normal signals from Congress.
I don't know that you need any more signals than you already have. And with respect to why Congress might have done it, I think one of the reasons Congress might have limited it to individuals and not corporations. Let me give two reasons. First is because as a general international law matter, again, as explained in the Kiobel opinion, corporations aren't subjects of the kind of norms that are at issue here, and Congress might well have wanted to adhere to that understanding. And the flip side of that, of course, is that individuals in corporations are subject to international law norms, and Congress might well have concluded that was sufficient.
Maybe.
Particularly.
You may well be right about that.
And particularly, Your Honor, in light of the following, which I think is another important indicia that the court should bear in mind, When the Supreme Court considered the question of corporate liability in Bivens actions, which Justice Scalia described as the closest analog to the federal common law actions that the court would recognize under the Alien Tort Statute, mm-hmm. the Supreme Court said there would be no corporate liability for Bivens actions. And
Bivens is not a statutory case.
It's not, but it has
to. We have a statute here. It's a completely different, at least I think it's a different situation. We have a statute, and obviously in a non-statutory case like Bivens, the court's worried about expanding it too far. Here we have a federal law, Alien Tort Statute.
But Judge Tuttle, I guess I would draw the following distinction, which I think is very important. All this statute does, and we know this from Sosa, is to give jurisdiction.
Right.
The cause of action is defined by federal courts as a matter of federal common law,
right.
which is exactly what happens under Bivens. Courts fashion the scope of the federal common law cause of action. So the Supreme Court said in Malesko.
The difference here is we have a federal statute giving the courts express jurisdiction to do that, whereas we don't in Bivens.
You have a statute that gives jurisdiction.
We don't in Bivens. That's the difference.
You have a Supreme Court decision that says you ought to exercise great caution in fashioning the contours of that, and I think it would be inconsistent with the great caution to say that corporations are covered.
So setting aside the Bivens thing, is your answer to my question about Judge Edwards' view about international law directing us to look to local law for corporate liability? Your answer to that basically is the Second Circuit got it right.
Well, I have two answers. One is that the Second Circuit got it right, but the second is, even if the Second Circuit didn't get it right, I don't know how you get around the Torture Victims Protection Act. At least it seems to me, at the very least I would say this, Your Honor, it would be inconsistent with the great caution that's mandated by the Supreme Court to reach out and encompass corporate liability.
What about the fact, as Mr. Hoffman points out, that the TVPA's legislative history, which is cited in SOSA, specifically indicates it's not to disturb ATS 1350 actions?
So
doesn't that really take away the signal that you otherwise would draw from the TVPA in this instance?
No, I wouldn't say so, Your Honor. First of all, we have no idea what Congress particularly meant by that. In other words, we don't know where Congress would have thought
one way to read it is that Congress meant for the ATS to proceed along its course, and that the adoption of the TVPA, at least again in the legislative history, was not supposed to disturb that, however it winds its way along its course. Isn't that the natural reading of that legislative history?
I don't know that it is, Your Honor, and at least in the after SOSA, which directs that courts should take into account congressional guidance, it seems to me that the prudent exercise of caution would dictate that we're not going to fashion the federal common law cause of action beyond what Congress has suggested. And of course Congress can come in and specify otherwise at some point in time.
But that's not
the
issue.
But from the perspective of course they wouldn't do that in the first instance.
That's not the issue in this case. We're not faced here, at least I don't think we are, with the question SOSA faced. You concede, as I read your brief, that torture, extrajudicial executions, and prolonged detentions do violate well-accepted norms of international law, right?
Yeah, we don't.
This is not a SOSA case. We're not looking to. In other words, for plaintiffs to win, they don't have to establish a new norm. We're just talking about who's liable for violating these customary norms, correct?
Yeah, and whether.
So SOSA really doesn't speak to that. All the caution in SOSA, as I read it, was directed at warning courts about recognizing these new norms. They have to be well established. We have to worry that, you know, it's maybe more appropriate for Congress to do it. But none of that, as I read it, isn't that right, has anything to do with this question.
No, I guess I would disagree, Your Honor.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think what the court was instructing in SOSA is that lower courts ought to exercise great caution in fashioning the federal common law cause of actions that implement the alien.
And we're not doing that here.
You absolutely are.
Uh-huh.
We're trying to make the assessment of whether the federal common law cause of action, with all due respect, we're trying to make the assessment of whether the federal common law cause of action that implements the Alien Tort Statute
includes
corporate liability.
Yes.
Right.
But you see my point about it. It's a step back from what SOSA was concerned about, right? Which is recognizing the norm. And your point is well taken. Obviously, we have to be careful. The warning in SOSA applies to this also. That's why I asked counsel for plaintiff that question.
Right.
But do you see my point that it's at a step back?
I do, Judge.
Okay. So SOSA isn't as directive to us on this issue as it would be if, say, there was some debate about whether prolonged illegal detention were recognizable as a, you know, as a norm of international law, right?
It's one more step removed than that direct relevance, but I think it's shades of gray rather than black and white.
Okay. And that's my, everything that's, we that's do is shades of gray, right? This case would be a lot easier if it weren't shades of gray.
So you want us both, as the Second Circuit did, to look to customary international law in terms of the norm and also in terms of the nature of the remedy?
Well, I guess I wouldn't say that it's the nature of the remedy, because I think the question of whether corporate liability exists goes to liability, not remedy.
All right, but who can be a defendant?
Right.
And if we look to international law, what would we find?
You would find what the Second Circuit found, which is
that... No, we would find that all these nations hold their corporations liable for torts. Wouldn't we find that?
As a matter of domestic law, Judge Rogers, but not as a matter of customary international law, and that's a critical distinction.
And it cites the Rome Statute. All right, and then all these amicus briefs tell us what's wrong with doing that, as does Judge LaValle. And so why would we adopt that approach?
Well, because, I mean, Judge LaValle, with all due respect to him, didn't persuade the rest of the court. And I think the majority in Kiobel had it right with respect to the Rome Statute, which is that the reason Rome Statute doesn't extend corporate liability is because there's an insufficient international consensus as to whether corporations can form mens rea.
But it was going to the criminal court, correct?
I'm sorry?
It was going to the criminal court and addressing that. All right, we're in the civil area. It wasn't addressing that at all.
I don't think that distinction matters, Judge Rogers, for the following reason. The reason corporations don't come within the compass of the criminal law would apply equally under civil law, and that is that corporations
But you made the argument. They don't have the mens rea, but, in an aiding and abetting, that would be sufficient, depending on what the standard is, says the Second Circuit.
I'm not quite sure I follow the connection to aiding and abetting, but...
you're saying they can't be a direct...
Right. That corporations don't form the mens rea, and that's as a matter of international law. But in further answer to your question, Judge Rogers, even if you disagreed on whether international law governed the question, and I'm belaboring the point, I would say that if you looked at domestic law, the Torture Victims Protection Act, coupled with the Supreme Court's treatment on Malesko, would say there's no corporate liability.
Let me ask you this. Just one question about... You're relying very heavily on Judge Cabranes' decision. What's your reaction to, the amicus brief from the, and he relied very heavily on Nuremberg, right?
Yep.
And he said Nuremberg only held individuals responsible, but not corporations. And that amicus brief from the, from those historians pretty clearly indicated that that's wrong, that the way to look at this isn't just what happened in Nuremberg, but that the Allies held both individuals and corporations responsible. They just held corporations responsible by seizing their assets and essentially destroying them. And they didn't exist by the time of, or at least they had been punished by the time of Nuremberg. That's their argument, and that does have historical, that is probably correct, don't you think?
Well, I don't know that goes to the question of whether customary international law, the customary
No, but it undermines it undermines the Second Circuit's decision pretty significantly.
I don't
because they rely very heavily on Nuremberg, and that seems to have been wrong.
Right, but I don't. But all the Second Circuit was talking about was whether the customary international law norms extend to corporate liability. It may well be that in state-to-state relations, there are other reasons to exact consequences against corporations, and I think it's undisputed that the Nuremberg Tribunal itself had no authority to address actions.
Correct, and that's because the Allies had dealt with A.G. Farben and the other companies part of the Nazi government as differently. They had seized their assets. They had punished them that way. That's the whole point of that amicus brief.
Well, but Your Honor, there's a subsequent consideration of corporate liability under the Rome Statute, where France, I think it was, specifically suggested that the Rome Statute should hold corporations liable. But the international community rejected that proposition for the reasons I mentioned.
Well, the other amicus brief says, we don't look at the Rome Statute as displacing the Alien Tort Statute. So, and who may be a defendant under that?
I think many courts have looked to the Rome Statute to define the norms, and it seems to me you would also look to it to decide whether there's corporate liability. And the answer to the Rome Statute gives
us no. The Second Circuit decided to look at that, but then didn't look at what happens to corporations in all of these states.
And Judge Russell, I think there's an important distinction there, which is that corporations, as a matter of domestic law in many states, may be civilly liable. But the question is whether corporations are liable for customary international law. It's the same question that the Second Circuit addressed, that Judge Friendly addressed in an old opinion on the Alien Tort Statute, where it's true that every domestic state bars theft. But that doesn't mean that theft is a norm of customary international law. And by the same token, it may be true that every country or many countries have corporate civil liability, but that doesn't make corporate civil liability a part of customary international law.
On the great caution point, another thing Sosa pointed out was the statement of interest is potentially relevant from the U.S. government, footnote 21. And what's your position on where we are on that question right now? With respect to the federal claims, how relevant is this? Is the, as Mr. Hoffman characterized it, old, outdated statement of interest as modified or interpreted by the Solicitor General's brief, which itself is old and potentially outdated?
Well, I mean, of course, you only get to that if you thought there was corporate liability and there was aiding and abetting liability. But
exactly.
If we're past those,
you and Judge Tatel were talking about the great caution. Another aspect of the great caution is pay attention to what the U.S. government says.
Yeah, I think that those statements remain fully valid today. And there's two considerations I'd point to. First, there's the 2002 statement of interest by the State Department. And then in 2005, the government filed another statement which says that their concerns remain fully valid today. So we at least know that as of 2005, the concerns remain valid. And then we have nothing further.
Wait, that 2005 is before our opinion on the interlocutory appeal, right?
Say, what do we do with that?
I mean, Didn't we invited the State Department to give us more specific information if it wanted to? It hasn't done it.
Right, and I guess the question would be, which way does that cut? And from my perspective,
we interpreted the United States statement of interest as not asking for dismissal
of the state law claims.
Yes.
Right, but I was speaking of the federal claims.
And I thought even after our decision, the Solicitor General reiterates.
Yes.
I read the CERDOP reiterates the opposition to the federal law.
Right.
Claims.
So I think
now that's still 3 years ago.
That's still 3 years ago, and I guess at some point,
a long time? I mean, should we still be relying on a statement of interest in a CERDOP 3 years ago?
I think you would, Your Honor, and I think the general presumption I would apply is that the government's words in cases of this sort remain good unless the government comes in and tells the court otherwise. And that's what we usually do with executive orders. It doesn't matter that administrations change. We treat executive orders as continuing to state the policy of the government unless and until the government comes in and tells the court otherwise.
But suppose as a result of this appeal, again, this is just a hypothetical.
Sure.
Suppose it goes back to the district court on an alien tort statute theory of corporate aiding and abetting liability. Okay, and suppose also we think Indonesia law applies, not D.C. law.
The state claims, right?
Yeah. And suppose also there's no further discovery. Don't you think it would be wise to give the State Department, before we assume that the State Department thinks that case, that way structured, would present a foreign policy problem, don't you think we should give the State Department an opportunity to tell us that?
Yeah, well,
it's never really focused on that.
I wouldn't stand in the way of asking the State Department.
Well, no, let it tell the district court.
But I guess
it can always tell the district court that if it comes back that way.
It could. My only point is that in the absence of a contrary indication from the State Department, I would assume that the things that the State Department has said so far remain fully governing. That's the bottom line, and I think that's with respect to the federal claims.
The federal claims, even the existence of the federal claims, the United States is opposed to. That's how I read the CERDOP.
Yes, as do I.
Not the state law claims.
But with the state law claims, and maybe we can turn to that. I'm happy to
do it in a minute or two. I have another question.
Sure, please. Before we turn to that, let me address.
I have one more area too.
Yeah. Well, I think as to the federal claims, I wholeheartedly endorse what you said, Judge Kavanaugh. I don't read anything in the record in any submission that would cause us to revisit what the State Department initially said, which is that it has a problem with the federal claims at the very least.
But Judge Tatel makes a good point, and Mr. Hoffman, that it's. Several years ago, they'll have plenty of opportunity to come in and reiterate, as they did in 05, if they want to. I guess
to me, I wouldn't put the burden on the government to reiterate. I would put the burden on the government to disavow. I think we ordinarily assume that the government means what it says until it tells us otherwise. And I don't know why that ordinary assumption that applies to executive orders, that applies to regulations, that applies across administrations, wouldn't also apply here.
A letter that was filed in 2002. At that point, the federal claims were still pending.
That's right.
And yet, I know all we had were the state law claims in front of us on the interlocutory appeal, but we interpreted that 2002 letter in a manner that did not suggest dismissal was required.
Of the state law claims?
Yes. Right. I know, but I'm saying we interpreted the letter not to be calling for a dismissal. In other words, we thought it was, you know, there was language that my colleague pointed out the court focused on in terms of a footnote in the letter about, you know, this is all
right.
Tentative and speculative depending on how the case evolves.
Right. Well, I guess as I read the court's opinion at that time around, you were addressing the narrow question of whether there was appellate jurisdiction.
Right,
but even
right,
if you look
I'm
at it,
I'm trying to suggest we decided it, but all I was
right,
saying is
and
we're
I think,
dealing with a 2002 right. statement.
But I think after that, as Judge Kavanaugh points out, you had the Solicitor General submission in the Supreme Court, which ratified the notion, as I read it, that the federal government was interested in the federal dismissal of the federal claims because of the foreign policy consequences that might attend continued litigation of those federal claims.
I think what Judge Rogers is getting at is that it's not really sensible to read the original statement of interest as distinguishing between federal and state claims.
Thank you.
Well, I would agree
I didn't.
With that. And I think you're right about that.
So if the majority held, as it did, that it's not calling for dismissal, doesn't that apply, I think, Judge Rogers is suggesting, to both the federal and state claims, and that interpretation is binding on all of us.
Well, I guess I don't attach talismanic significance to whether the letter on its four corners calls for dismissal. What I would look at is whether the letter says that continued litigation of the case would raise serious foreign policy concerns. And I think the letter on its face says that. And if you, to the extent
except that,
that
the D.C. Circuit didn't agree with you.
No, I don't. I think what the D.C. Circuit
panel didn't agree with that.
No, what the court, I think, was focused on was whether it called for dismissal. And whether or not it calls for dismissal, I guess it seems to me what's
well, if it causes, if it's just serious foreign policy concerns, then, I mean, the courts can take account of that and how they fashion discovery and things like that, right?
That's potentially one way to do it. Yeah. Now, on the question of discovery, I would say this. I don't think that it's possible to litigate this case further without permitting the very sort of discovery that the district court said couldn't happen without interfering with Indonesian sovereignty.
The counsel just told you she didn't need any more discovery.
And I'm not quite sure I follow that, because if you look at the discovery plan, I think this is Joint Appendix 2869, if I remember the page correctly, plaintiffs themselves, and this is just plaintiffs, this is not defendants, plaintiffs themselves call for discovery at least of lay witnesses. And I don't know where those lay witnesses are if they're not in Indonesia. Which makes all the sense in the world. And, of course, that doesn't
even get
to the
point. Isn't the discovery issue really an issue for remand anyway? Because at some point, I don't see how we could get into that here. At some point, the district court might conclude that discovery is too much given the previously stated objections and requires dismissal. But at this point, I don't know how we could say that the discovery requires dismissal now.
I guess my point is this, that I don't see how the litigation can proceed without some discovery in Indonesia. Certainly we would need discovery in Indonesia. And as to that, I'm not suggesting that this court would define the contours of the discovery that would need to be had. What I'm suggesting is, now that we know,
your
discovery would have to happen in Indonesia.
Your discovery isn't going to create any problems, is it, for the Indonesian government? You're going to want discovery from the plaintiffs.
Oh, I think, we would want quite a bit of discovery, Your Honor, as to exactly who was responsible for the alleged misconduct of the soldiers. And that would go to the question of, for example, was the government responsible for it? Were we responsible for it? And those kinds of things would directly implicate Indonesian sovereignty. Understand?
Mr. Reisman was suggesting that was kind of a cooked-up discovery request to trigger the political question issue. I'm pretty sure that's what she was implying.
She may have been implying that, but I'm not quite sure I follow it, because it goes directly to who would be responsible for the torts. And that's the only way that we can defend ourselves, is to ask questions about who's actually responsible for the alleged misconduct of the soldiers. And bear in mind, there were thousands of soldiers in Indonesia at this point. I mean, it's not as if there were 15 soldiers that we all know who they were and we can particularly identify what misconduct they engaged in. There would have to be all sorts of discovery about which soldiers we were talking about, who was responsible for the conduct of the soldiers, were they directly involved in the prosecution of a war at that time. All of those things come into play in order to permit us to adequately defend ourselves against these allegations.
Can I want to ask you about one of Mr. Hoffman's arguments this morning. And it was in response to your argument in the brief that the Alien Tort Statute has no extraterritorial application, right?
Right.
Applies only to the United States. His point about SOSA, I thought, was interesting. which is that if you were right about that, SOSA wouldn't have come out the way it did.
No, I think
the entire decision rests on the assumption that the Alien Tort Statute, or at least the common law norms recognized pursuant to it, do apply extraterritorially.
I guess the short answer to me, Your Honor, is that SOSA had no need to address that question because it resolved the ETS claim against
the fact is
different rationale.
True, but it could have resolved it the other way. In fact, as he pointed out, and I looked this up too, the government argued, the title of one of its argument section is Section 1350 does not apply extraterritorially.
And then when you
combine that with the fact that, and not even the dissenters in SOSA argued that, nobody did. So what we have is a Supreme Court decision. I mean, it would have been wrestling with the question of whether norm is sufficiently well developed to be recognized. And that had to have been on the assumption. I mean, I don't see, I can understand you making this argument to the Supreme Court. I don't understand how we, as a lower federal court, can go there in view of SOSA.
Well, I guess, you know.
Help me with that.
I don't think SOSA resolved the question, so it necessarily arises. Now, I would want to put in context how the presumption applies here, because what we're asking again is how you would fashion a federal common law cause of action. And to me, when you're fashioning a federal common law cause of action, you take into account settled canons like the principle against extraterritoriality. And the way I would do it is the way the United States suggested that it should be done in its brief to the Supreme Court in the apartheid cases, suggesting that the court shouldn't recognize aiding and abetting liability, especially aiding and abetting liability that calls into question the extraterritorial conduct of a foreign sovereign against its own citizens.
Anyway, I wanted to ask you about that argument in your brief. Is your argument as broad as the amicus brief? The amicus brief, I think it's the Washington Legal Foundation, right? Their argument is that there should be no aiding and abetting liability at all. Your argument seemed to be narrower.
I think you'd only have to address the narrower point, Your Honor, uh-huh. which is the point that the United States made in its submission.
Yeah.
Is there aiding and abetting liability in the circumstances of this case,
uh-huh.
where what's at issue is the conduct of a foreign sovereign in its own territory against its own citizens?
Okay.
And the court would have discretion.
Doesn't CIL recognize aiding and abetting liability?
I'm sorry?
Doesn't CIL recognize?
Oh, customary, I'm sorry.
Yeah,
customary international law recognize aiding and abetting liability. In other words, if we follow your methodology on the question of corporate liability, doesn't that methodology lead to a clear recognition of aiding and abetting liability?
I think the difference is this, Your Honor. You would still have to ask the question of whether it's appropriate to recognize aiding and abetting liability as a matter of federal common law. And on that step, I think the Supreme Court's decision in Central Bank comes into play.
Well, but that's easy. I mean, we have a circuit precedent that does. I mean, our case law recognizes aiding and abetting liability. It rests on the restatement.
No, not as a matter of federal common law in implementing the Alien Tort Statute, which is the relevant question.
But the only question is, why should we not use that?
Because for all the reasons that the United States explained in its submission to the Supreme Court, which is
that we don't even need to. I mean, as Judge Kavanaugh pointed out to you, international law does recognize aiding and abetting liability.
No, but I think there's two steps to the inquiry, Judge Tatel, with respect. Uh-huh. I think first you have to ask the question whether international law recognizes it, and then you have to ask the question, and I think this follows directly from SOSA, whether federal courts should do so as a matter of federal common law. And there, I would be governed by the Supreme Court's admonition in Central Bank that with respect to civil liability, unless there's affirmative indication.
Yeah, Central Bank involved the securities laws, right?
Yes.
I mean, that was a statute. The question was, what did that statute mean? Here we have the ATS, which is a jurisdictional statute only, which SOSA says to figure out what the common law, what the cause of actions are, we look to common law. So, you know, I mean, it seems to me that the Denver Bank case isn't that right? Isn't it just a completely different case? It's a statutory interpretation case. This one isn't.
It's a statutory interpretation case, but it seems to me that in fashioning federal common law, you would take into account, I think it would follow a fortiori, that if as a matter of statutes, we don't read aiding and abetting into statutes.
But that particular statute, the Section 10B.
Oh, but I think Central Bank sets forth much more than that particular statute. It sets forth a methodology for deciding whether there's aiding and abetting liability.
How a substantive statute is interpreted. But ATS is a jurisdictional statute, and we look to common law for the cause of action. So why don't we look to common law for deciding whether there's aiding and abetting liability?
Because you're deciding how to fashion federal common law. You don't just look to any common law and decide whether it applies. You have to take into account operative canons of construction. And one of them is that we don't construe statutes to provide aiding and abetting liability in the absence of indication. So why would we do that when we're fashioning federal
common law? Because common law is different from statutory law.
Right, but I think it's...
That's why
it takes its direction.
Courts have their own common law authority recognized by the Supreme Court in SOSA. Well, it's different from statutory common law. But obviously, Congress could change it.
The other reason...
Congress could pass a law saying there's no corporate, no aiding and abetting liability under the Alien Tort Statute. Congress could do that like that.
Well, the other reason, Judge Tatel, is that the reason there's no aiding and abetting liability in the civil context is because of the absence of a prosecutorial screen. That's a very important indication. That's a very important consideration, rather. And it's one that the Supreme Court pointed to in SOSA itself at page 727, that courts have to be cautious in recognizing federal common law causes of action because there's no prosecutorial screen.
So on the methodology, your point is first you look to whether it's recognized customary international law, and then in exercising the great caution, even if it is, there can be other indications in federal law that require you not to allow it nonetheless.
Right.
So the TVPA, central bank. A central bank seems a little farther afield than the TVPA on that, but I...
It may be, but it's still an important indication, and I think that two-step methodology comes from SOSA itself.
Right. Okay, so a different question, which is assume that there were two hard questions presented to the court in SOSA, one on recognizing these norms and what the ATS was, and the other on whether it had extraterritorial application. It resolved the issue on one ground and not the other, and so assume that I think we have to figure out for ourselves whether the presumption against extraterritorial application has force here, and that we don't assume that SOSA is so held. Okay. It still doesn't mean you win on it. It's a tough issue, and what do you do with, I think my first instinct was, as Mr. Hoffman said, this has been around for 30 years, and this would be very odd at this point to find that. And then secondly, there's a 1795 Attorney General opinion, which, while admittedly confused, confusing to read, may not have been confused in its writing at the time, but seems confusing now, seems to suggest that there is such extraterritorial application.
The 1795 Attorney General opinion, I think, applies to the high seas.
Okay, it's ambiguous, I'll grant you that.
Right.
Okay.
Well, I don't know that
you
it's
don't
ambiguous.
Think it's ambiguous. Okay.
I don't think it's. I think it clearly applies to the high seas, and our principle doesn't apply to the high seas because there's no territorial sovereignty.
It's unclear whether the AG was saying there could be civil liability just on the high seas or also for acts committed in the foreign country.
I mean, that I guess
you don't think it's unclear.
I don't know that it's unclear enough, at least to raise an issue on it. Okay. Now, with respect to the case law, that's true, and I wouldn't mean to suggest that this is an easy question, but the government has said repeatedly that the presumption against extraterritoriality applies to the ATS after all of these cases have been decided. And I think part of the force of that comes from the Supreme Court's recent reaffirmation of the force of the presumption against extraterritoriality, just recently, for example, in the Morrison case. So whatever doubt there would have been about the force of that submission before, I think it's all the more fortified now. And that's, I think, what Judge Kleinfeld was getting to in his recent decision and his recent opinion in Rio Tinto, that after the Morrison case, there could be no doubt about the force of the presumption against extraterritoriality and the extent to which that ought to be brought to bear on the question.
What about Mr. Hoffman's point, which he stated that the whole idea of the ATS was to make clear to the international community that the United States was abiding by the law of nations?
Well, I think if you look at the historical record, the international discord that gave rise to the Alien Tort Statute involved domestic conduct, which is assaults against, and this is covered in SOSA, which was assaults against ambassadors on United States soil. So I don't think that the historical record necessarily supports the proposition that the Alien Tort Statute was meant to apply abroad.
But it's been applied by courts for 30 years. Yeah. But, you rely very heavily on the corporate liability issue on the Torture Act. Doesn't the Torture Act, Congress passed the Torture Act, 25 years ago? Yeah. The Torture Act applies extraterritorially. I mean, it shows us that Congress isn't particularly worried about American statutes being applied extraterritorially. In fact, the Torture Act can be used by aliens against aliens in U.S. courts, right? The latest we know from, the Alien Tort Statute history is at least murky. People argue both sides of it 250 years ago. The latest, the modern Congress has passed a statute that does apply extraterritorially.
Right.
So shouldn't that tell us that that same statute, the legislative history of it, that House report makes clear that it's preserving the Alien Tort Statute. So it seems to me that, or why shouldn't I view that as fairly strong evidence that extending the, recognizing the extraterritorial application of the tort statute is not a problem?
Well, I guess what that tells you is that the presumption is just that, a presumption. So the presumption obviously can be overcome.
Right.
And if it was overcome in the Torture Victims Protection Act, that doesn't mean that it doesn't otherwise exist. So if plaintiffs want to bring a claim for torture apply it extraterritorially.
That's a good point. I mean, Congress could have been explicit with the Alien Tort Statute just the way it was with the torture statute. But it wasn't, and now we're here 2.5 centuries later trying to figure out what it means. And what we do have is a statement by a modern Congress,
I think, Judge Taylor,
a 20th century Congress, that extraterritorial application of U.S. common law is not a problem.
Well, the presumption applies explicitly where there's ambiguity. And so if you thought that the Alien Tort Statute was ambiguous, to me the presumption kicks in at that point. The presumption obviously can't apply in some, if you thought that the Torture Victims Protection Act spoke clearly the question. I guess I would leave it at that.
Thank you.
If there are further questions on the federal issues, I'm of course happy to address them.
Do you have any point you wanted to make that we've prevented you from making?
No, by our questions?
Yes.
I don't think so on the
all
federal
right,
claims.
I would like an opportunity to address.
Can we solve the diversity problem?
Diversity
problem simply be solved by, is Exxon Indonesia an indispensable party?
We have arguments that it is, Your Honor.
So why shouldn't we just let the district court figure that out?
You could. I mean, that you'd.
Right. That would solve the problem, right? If it's indispensable, the case has to go. If it's not, they can dismiss Exxon, right?
Right. But on the question of jurisdiction, that's
right.
Correct.
Okay.
But what I'd like to spend a little time addressing, if I could, just briefly, is
on
state common. We haven't even talked about state common law yet.
Yeah.
And I think there's a very forceful argument, and Judge Kavanaugh hit on this in his dissenting opinion from the last time this case was before the court, that the state common law claims are preempted. And it's under principles of foreign affairs preemption. And the two cases I think that speak directly to the question are the Supreme Court's decision in Jernig and this Court's recent decision in Saleh versus Titan Corporation. On Saleh,
the preemption arose really from the fact that the Constitution itself assigns the war-making function to the federal government, not the state government. So I don't know that, I mean, there's a lot of discussion on Saleh which you could draw from, but I think Jernig's where you need to focus your attention.
I guess our point.
Saleh is a much stronger case, in my judgment, for preemption than what we have here, because it's a state trying to regulate the U.S. military war effort through tort law, which struck the majority in that case as not being appropriate given the constitutional structure. We don't have the state here doing that. The state's regulating an American corporation, perhaps a foreign government. That's much different. That's more Jernig than
right. Saleh. Well, and I wouldn't want to quibble with Your Honor's understanding of Saleh, given that you were on the panel, or the pronunciation of the party's name. But I'm happy to talk about Jernig. I'll only make this one preliminary point, which is that, of course, our argument here is dependent on the Constitution's allocation of powers, too, because the Constitution allocates the conduct of foreign relations to the political branches. And at root, our argument here is that the recognition of a state common law action conflicts with the Constitution's allocation of the foreign affairs.
Right, but normally in this kind of circumstance where it's in effect a state regulating the foreign country, and Jernig, put Jernig aside for a second, normally we would look for some indication from Congress or the executive branch that this state suit would interfere with the foreign affairs, with the foreign relations of the United States. We don't have that with respect to the state law claims. I thought we did have it in the statement of interest, but turns out the SG's brief says no.
Well, I guess a couple of points. First, there was no executive submission in Saleh, but more to the point.
In this case,
the Supreme Court, the Solicitor General submission specifically, and I think pointedly, points out the prospect that the claims might be preempted. That issue wasn't before the Supreme Court. But the Solicitor General nonetheless went out of its way to specifically endorse your suggestion, in your opinion, that these claims might well be preempted.
But I was focused on the statement of interest in making that comment. And so it's unclear to me how much force foreign affairs preemption has without a statement of interest from the executive branch or some indication from Congress. Now, Jernig's your case on that.
Absolutely. I think Jernig speaks square to the question. And it's not as Your Honor pointed out, it's not just that there wasn't a statement of interest in Jernig. It's that there was a statement filed by the executive branch which disclaimed any effect or an undue burden on the
foreign relations. Very unusual state statute there, though, right? It really went into the operations of the foreign government in particular. Is the foreign government going to confiscate the money or not? We don't have something quite that direct here. First of all, if the suit here was against Indonesia, okay, the suit's against Exxon. It's not directly getting into the foreign government, or is it? How do you want to respond to that?
Well, I think it is, because it necessarily calls into question the actions of the Indonesian military. And if you buy the aiding and abetting theory, for example, you can only have aiding and abetting if there's liability in the first place on the part of the state actors. The question would be whether the private actor is aiding and abetting the state actors. So you necessarily are calling into question the actions of government in Indonesia. So I think those concerns are foursquare in play, and the United States wouldn't have filed the statement it did if they weren't. The other point I'd make is this, Your Honor, and that in Zernig, the government filed a statement that said that there was no undue burden, but the court nonetheless found that foreign affairs preemption kicked in. And I think the reason is that the judiciary has an independent role in policing the divide between what questions should be decided by the states and what questions should be decided by the political branches. And so, and Justice Stewart described this in his concurring opinion in Zernig, where he said, whatever the State Department might say at one particular point in time, the judiciary has its own independent responsibility to provide this, to police this line, and that's a constant. And we think the same sort of principle would apply here. The judiciary has the responsibility.
When Zernig comes up again in Garamendi, though, the court doesn't exactly embrace it with open arms. It's kind of a grudging.
But the court, I mean, you could read Garamendi in many ways, but I think the court, one thing the court definitely didn't do is it didn't disavow anything in Zernig.
That's true.
So Zernig remains governing, and certainly it remains governing on the courts of appeals, with all respect. And I think the lesson to draw from Zernig is that where you have a state law that implicates the foreign relations, that state law is preempted, especially if, as in this case, the state interests are de minimis. And I think the state interests here are de minimis because everything relevant to this matter happened in Indonesia.
Suppose the district court should have applied Indonesia law.
Yes.
Then that solves this problem, right?
No, I don't think it does, Your Honor, because I think preemption applies regardless of what body of law would be brought to bear on the equation. Now, I'd say a couple things about Indonesian law, if I might, and then I'll close. And that is that the Indonesian law, the argument for applying the law of a foreign sovereign in a case like this is based on reciprocity. It's based on comity between nations. And you can't have that kind of comity-based understanding when the foreign sovereign whose laws would apply has come into the court and said that they object to the proceedings. At that point, I think the argument for applying Indonesian law evaporates. And so you're left with a situation where the law that should apply, but for that objection, can't be applied because of the objection.
Have you seen this most recent letter from the
Indonesian? I haven't, Your Honor.
All right.
I haven't. But I take
it's
it from the...
very carefully written. I mean, it's not quite as encompassing as we've been talking about.
Okay, well, I would obviously have to see it before I could comment.
Yes, of course. All right. Anything further?
No.
No. The court has no further questions.
Thank you very much.
Thanks.
All right. Counsel for appellants on the state law claims.
I'd just like to quickly discuss choice of law. I've got six cases where D.C. choice of law rules have been applied to torts that occurred overseas, and they picked a domestic law in each case. The first case is Acosta Orellana versus CropLife. That was the case this year. A tort occurred in Ecuador. They applied D.C. choice of law rules and ended up with D.C. law. In Holland versus Islamic Republic, same thing. Torture in Lebanon, they applied D.C. choice of law rules, ended up with Kentucky law. In Wyatt versus Syrian Arab Republic, torture in Turkey ended up with, I think, Tennessee or Kentucky law. These are all cited in our brief. Reed versus Islamic Republic, torture in Lebanon ended up with Massachusetts law. Friends for All Children, D.C. choice of law, ended up with D.C. law. Jankovic versus International Crisis Group applied D.C. law for misrepresentation in Serbia, Croatia. So, and I think there are probably more in our brief, and there's a series of cases that we cited in the beginning on the standing section, which were all diversity cases, and many of those also relied on domestic law. And also, Linder versus Puerto Carrero is an 11th Circuit case with torture in Nicaragua, where they ended up going proceeding under common law claims under Florida law. So I think it's actually relatively typical for courts to evaluate and do the interest test, and D.C. has an extremely strong preference for if you cannot prove up adequately the foreign law, that D.C. law applies. That's an Operungo and Reimer versus Poole, and also if there is no conflict. And the district court did not find a conflict. And I just want to also emphasize how long we spent on choice of law. There were seven expert declarations and rounds of briefing. So we went through this pretty extensively, and he did not find a conflict and found
in part, I think, for judicial efficiency that D.C. law.
Conflict on punitive damages doesn't qualify as a conflict?
I'm just talking right now about the substantive law. We would concede there was a conflict on punitive damages, and that's a different analysis. I'm talking right now just about the substantive law. And
Thank you.
All
right, counsel for appellants on the federal claims.
Mr. Honor, I think we've probably discussed pretty much everything, but I just wanted to make a couple of points. One is the opinion in Kiobel, and I think counsel ignore the general principles of law part of international law when the references are entirely to customary international law. General principles of law are accepted as international law. They are in Article 38 of the ICJ statute. They're in the Restatement of Foreign Relations Law of the United States. They're in the Flores opinion, which was actually written by Judge Cabranes. General principles of law, the one that the experts that in the briefs have indicated, is that in every legal system in every country, there is corporate civil liability for these kinds of torts. And that is not the independent sort of, that's not the ITT versus Venicap reference that counsel made from the Second Circuit.
Does that mean if a lot of nations prohibit something as a matter of each nation's domestic law, that that's a CIL norm enforceable under the ATS?
No, it doesn't. And in fact, the other point that I want to make is that counsel's repeatedly talked about how in a federal common law cause of action, which is what Sosa says this is, one should look to different kinds of sources. It's uniquely appropriate, it seems to me, to look to general principles of law, even if they're not customary international law in the sense that the violation is for ATS purposes, because that shows that the United States is not only enforcing its own principles, but it's enforcing principles that have some resonance throughout the entire world. And so with respect to things like corporate liability, not only is that a commonplace within U.S. tort law, it's commonplace every place. And the Supreme Court has used general principles of law. For example, in the First National City Bank case, general principles of law were used to determine whether the corporate shell should be pierced so that claims against Cuba could go forward, for example. That's a matter of international law. That's part of Article 38. It can be used in this context as easily, and in fact would probably be the most appropriate thing to use. I think Sosa establishes that this is a federal common law cause of action. That's what it says. And that's clearly what the founders had in mind. There were no international rules in those days. The law of nations was enforced by the use of domestic principles. In the United Kingdom, the law of nations would have been enforced using domestic common law principles. That's what the founders understood. That's how the ATS is structured. If you have a tort, as opposed to some property claim, and there were disputes in those days between property and tort, given British creditors, and if you had a violation of the law of nations, then common law principles would be used by judges to enforce that. And that goes to the point that I think Judge Tatel made about Sosa being largely directed to the threshold norm, to the violation of the law of nations, about which is not an issue here. Because everything in Sosa is about that. That's what the issue was, whether a detention of 23 hours in Mexico was a violation of the law of nations of the sort that was actionable under the Alien Tort Statute. And the words about judicial caution and practical consequences.
Suppose a norm was only enforceable against states.
Okay. Right. You mean by state?
Under customary international law.
Right.
Under your theory, why wouldn't an alien be able to sue an individual or a corporation for that, given that the norm, torture, extrajudicial killing, is defined by customary international law? It shouldn't matter who the perpetrator is, right? Isn't that what you're saying? It doesn't matter who the perpetrator is.
Well,
the CIL has nothing to do, I think you've told us, with who the perpetrator is.
Well, only in the sense of whether there's state action or not.
Why does that matter? I mean, why do you
norm is defined that way.
Or aiding.
Well, yeah, I know, but why?
Right?
why does CIL, you've drawn a clear distinction, and this is logical, between the norm, what's the prohibited conduct,
right,
and who may be sued.
Right.
But you've, I think, conceded that if a state can't be sued under customary international law, they can't if it's only a state that can be sued under customary international law, that you can't bring an ATS claim against a corporation or individual.
Well, only
and so you've not maintained that strict divide that you've articulated between the norm and who may be sued.
Well, the norm doesn't talk so much about perpetrator as it does about whether there's state action. And so,
well, the state action sues the perpetrator.
But the thing is, there's under international
torture, under your torture committed by a state actor. Suppose
yes,
a norm were only a state action norm,
right.
You wouldn't bring a suit against a corporation for that. At least you don't think. We could allow something like that.
If a corporation itself, without any involvement of a state actor, set up a torture chamber mm-hmm. and tortured somebody, I think that is a tort but not a violation of international law. If on the other hand, there is a state actor involved
in that. And thus can't be maintained under... No, that's not what you're saying.
Well, what I'm saying is that if, say, for example, Exxon had a chamber where they tortured somebody. And I think that is not an international law claim that's actionable
okay.
under the ATS if only Exxon was involved.
Okay.
So if Exxon used one of its military people, who is a state actor, as the torturer because of their unique exercise.
And that's so,
expertise,
so you still
perhaps.
Require, and that's why you say you still have to be aiding and abetting or under
right.
color of law. And
right.
You think
in
that's
order
enough.
To, in order to have some nexus to the state action, and although there's a portion.
But I query why the state action.
Why is it required?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, I think that international law does draw some distinctions between the kinds of things that are subject to international prohibitions when states or some state action is involved and those that aren't. And for example, murder.
But state action really goes to who the perpetrator is.
But not in the category of perpetrator. It just goes to the fact that you have to find some connection to the state.
Yeah.
And an appropriate connection to the state. And in fact, although in their brief they say that there are no international principles of color of law. In fact, there are. I mean, international law is also concerned with situations in which private actors can have their actions attributed to the state or vice versa, actually. And the Eastman Kodak case from the Southern District of Florida is the one decision that actually talks about that some. But there are international authorities. So whether one decided that that was an issue to be decided by international law or domestic law, there are principles to decide that. Anyway, I don't know if there are other questions that you have.
The only point there was that it's interesting that state action's part of the norm as opposed to in the other box.
I think in the case, for example, of extrajudicial execution, the reason is to distinguish it from an ordinary murder. Mm-hmm. I think that's the point, that is drawn within that, and that's evolved itself over many years.
But you in this case, this
yes.
particular case, You agree that the allegations all require state action,
yes.
either as a state actor or as an aider or abettor, correct?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Right.
We do.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
We'll take the case under advisement.
Judge needs to have